Up next on Tapestry, we're off to visit what Jimmy Carter called the most historic square mile in America, the village of Lewiston, New York.
These areas here have been occupied by indigenous people for millennia.
It was the last stop on the Underground Railroad for freedom seekers on their daring journey across the Niagara River to Canada.
We have children come here from all over Western New York. They actually walk around the village and see these places for themselves.
And finally, we make a stop for a sweet treat at Hibbard's Original Frozen Custard.
It's a very humble legacy for us because it does touch a lot of people in the community. We still have people that come back and say, my first job was Hibbard's.
That's all coming up on Tapestry right after this.
Compact Science is your gateway to the science of everything in our region. Join host Sarah Jane Gomlick-Green and investigate the geology of Niagara Falls, discover the chemistry in sponge candy, and learn how density affects lake effect snow. Watch Compact Science on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
Welcome to Tapestry. I'm your host, Lynn Bader, and on this episode, we venture to Lewiston, New York, a village brimming with history and culture. The first stop, Art Park, with the producer of Indigenous programming, Michelle Elise Burnett. Michelle Elise, thank you so much for joining me here on this incredibly beautiful spring morning at Art Park.
It really is a beautiful day. We couldn't have picked a better day.
And where we're sitting right now on Art Park grounds, it's a beautiful example of the natural world. For more than 50 years, music lovers have come here to enjoy concerts. I'm one of them. But we're really here to shed light on something very different and a much deeper connection, the history of this land and of Indigenous people on this land.
Where we're sitting right now at the mouth of the Niagara River used to actually be Niagara Falls. And it has been pushed back since the Ice Age and all the way back to where we see it today. However, these areas here have been occupied by Indigenous people for millennia. Mm-hmm. And many different nations have lived on these lands. For that, we need to be grateful because they really were stewards of these lands and took care of these lands. Indigenous peoples are very connected to the natural world. And we see that all of our relatives, you hear the birds that are singing for us right now. That's an opera that we receive every day, and so many times we forget to be appreciative of that. The wind that goes through the trees, and that's the tree people, the tree nations, the waters. I mean, water is life, and water has energy and it has memory.
Tell me what it feels to sit here right now on an early spring, it's the beginning of spring, morning, and what that means to you as a Native person. Mm-hmm.
I had an elder say to me many, many years ago, Michelle Elise, you need to sit on Mother Earth every single day, whether it's raining, hailing, snowing, a beautiful sunny day like we have today, for 30 minutes minimum. And what you can feel is that energy, that love, that reciprocity that you receive from your mother. So to become in tune, we need to sit and to reflect and to listen. Something that we don't do that often anymore.
Talk a little bit about Art Park's commitment to honoring Mother Earth and the land that Art Park sits on.
So I'm going to go back a little bit, 40 plus years, probably about 50 years, 45 years ago.
Okay.
They established an Indian village here, and it was up for only a few years, very few. And we thought it was the beginning. I remember coming here with my mother, and it was like so exciting. We were all very happy and proud to be able to share our culture, our heritage, our beadwork, our, you know, just our medicines. And it closed, unfortunately, for what reasons, I have no idea.
But what does it feel like for you that it has started again, right, through the work that you do?
It's exhilarating. It's wonderful to know that you have a committed partner like Art Park to gift us this platform, to have our voices heard, to be seen, to be understood, and to also invite non-Indigenous and Indigenous people to come and circle with us,
annually for a number of years now, you've held a Strawberry Moon Festival. What is the Strawberry Moon? And what's the significance of the Strawberry Moon?
We have 13 moons, and each moon has a different name and a different purpose and a different ceremony. So in June, we celebrate the strawberry, which is the first berry that comes up from Mother Earth and shows herself. And we call that the heart berry. We make strawberry juice, for example, and it's supposed to help you cleanse, but also to help the heart. It's the only berry that has the seeds on the outside. So we talk about that protectiveness of the inner part of the berry. But also there's that story or that teaching that those seeds are vulnerable. So embrace that vulnerability. Our 6th annual Strawberry Moon Festival, we're going to keep it very organic, very interactive, land-based. We're going to have a discovery zone, which we've had before, but now it's going to be amplified, where families can come in of all ages and participate in workshops and creating their own craft that could be something like a medicine pouch. It could be two-row wampum bracelets. But at the same time that they're creating this, they're going to be learning history at the same time in many different ways. So we'll have elders, grandmothers, clan mothers, singers, songwriters, all those that actually are able to tell a story about the indigenous peoples, but in different ways. We have our master storyteller, Perry Ground, who works at the Smithsonian quite a bit, but it travels all over North America and all over the world, basically sharing stories, Haudenosaunee stories. It's to invite everyone to come back home here at Art Park and to really sort of enjoy being together and leaving all of our differences behind. Leave those behind. Leave those shoes outdoors and come on in and let's just be together in community. Let's be a family and let's enjoy this moment together.
You talked a little bit about other programming that is done throughout the year, right? What are some of the highlights for you?
So some of the programs that we have ignited here at Art Park are Spring Awakens programs, which happen right here at the Turtle. We sing, we dance, we offer our gratitude, our love to Mother Earth. We kind of like, I could say, sort of roll off that blanket of snow where she's been protecting all of those seeds all winter long for us and the roots.
We're ready to roll that blanket off, aren't we?
Yes, we are. and get ready for the growing season.
Okay.
This garden, for example, that we're sitting in the shape of a turtle. It was created by my friends here in Tuscarora.
Can you describe the garden?
We have the outside of the turtle behind you, and it's kind of in the shape of a sort of half circle. And we have plants growing out of there, and it's with river rocks, large river rocks that we built this up. And then behind you is the actual tail of the turtle.
And behind you is the head of the
turtle.
That's
right, okay. Exactly. And the head, if you notice, is facing the Niagara River.
But the significance of the turtle in indigenous culture, if people don't know, is what?
It's Turtle Island. We've been calling North America Turtle Island. But seriously, if you look at a map from a bird's eye view, you'll look at from Canada all the way down to the Panhandle, Florida. You will see the turtle's legs up in the Arctic on both sides.
Okay.
You'll see kind of like a head. And then you look at the body of North America. And then as you go all the way down to Florida, there's the tail.
Okay.
So it's quite fascinating that we call it Turtle Island.
Michelle, I just want to thank you. You have started this day out right for all of us.
Well, thank you so much for coming out and spending time with me. I really appreciate it. It's been an honor.
Michelle Elise was headed to share Indigenous history with an elementary classroom that afternoon, but not before she treated us with a song. There's no shortage of history in Lewiston. Next up, we'll meet with a couple of guys who are keeping it alive for generations to come, right after this salty snapshot of Lewiston history.
Every spring, in the village of Lewiston, something a little magical and a little crispy happens. It's the Smelt Festival, a beloved tradition that turns a humble little fish into the star of the show. Rooted in the fishing traditions of the Niagara River, the festival celebrates the annual smelt run, when thousands of silvery fish swim upstream from Lake Ontario into the lower Niagara River. A seasonal event that has both fed and fascinated the region for generations. Folks gather to enjoy the catch, crispy, salty, served with a side of small-town charm. Add in live music and neighbors swapping stories, and you've got a gem of a festival. And here's a fun fact. Smelt are an invasive species. Like many non-native fish, their numbers exploded after arrival, and they quickly became the lake's second most populous bait fish. What could have been an ecological challenge has become a reason to gather, celebrate, and enjoy something uniquely Lewiston.
As promised, this episode of Tapestry is a real treat for those who enjoy digging into history. Let's keep it going. I'm here right now with Ken Slogenhop. Did I get that right?
You did.
Yes, I did. Ken, you're the past president of the Lewiston Historical Association. Why is it important for you to preserve history and remain so dedicated to the work that you do here in Lewiston?
Well, for me, I've thought about this a lot. A lot of people are historically important because something happened there. Appomattox is important because the Civil War ended there. Lewiston's important because of layer after layer after layer through centuries of things that have happened here. Literally the birthplace of Niagara Falls. And as the falls receded, the rapids above and below the falls and the falls themselves restricted boat travel. And at that period, 400 years ago, boats were the only way to travel. What happened is there's a little gully in Art Park that people see all the time and don't appreciate what it is, but it's a last point of navigational access for a boat before Niagara Falls. And at that point, if you want to continue going into the Upper Great Lakes, you've got to get out of the water, climb up the escarpment, walk
with
6 miles.
With your boat.
With your boat and everything
and
else
everything
that's on your
on the boat.
Several trips probably.
Mm-hmm.
Put your boat back in the water, and then you can go on into Lake Erie and other places like that.
So literally, this was sort of a gateway, right? So St. Louis calls it the gateway to the West. But truly, this is a different kind of a gateway. You weren't getting anywhere unless you got through Lewiston.
Erie, Pennsylvania, Cleveland, Detroit, Green Bay, all those cities were created by people who came through this era. The French were the first to really get serious about coming here. And it's an interesting story because they came ostensibly to teach about Jesus Christ, but also to take advantage of opportunities such as the fur trade.
We didn't play a very significant role in the Revolutionary War, but the War of 1812 is a different story.
It is. During the Revolutionary War, this was still a wilderness. But during the War of 1812, the United States invaded Canada. And the army that went down to the river went down in this little gully in Art Park. They rode across a very difficult stretch of water because if you've seen the way the currents run, it's a tricky bit of business. That's the battle in which General Sir Isaac Brock was killed, making a counterattack, mm-hmm. and why Brock's monument exists in his honor today on Queenston Heights.
Before cars were really a thing, how did people travel from the United States to Canada and back?
In the late 1800s, you could come on a steamship from Toronto to Lewiston, get off the steamship, get on a Niagara Gorge train ride, and go right along the water in the lower rapids all the way to Niagara Falls, get off the train, see the Niagara Falls, and reverse the process and you do a day trip. So we could be getting 400 to 500,000 people a season coming through the village.
From Canada to the United States.
Canada, Rochester, all sorts of places did that.
Wow.
And this is a sleepy little village. We only have 2,700 people in it today. So it's never been much bigger than that.
Mm.
So it's pretty overwhelming, I think. Just layer after layer of important history has happened in this little community. And if we don't tell the story, nobody else will. So we appreciate the opportunity to get this story out.
After Ken walked me through some of Lewiston's remarkable past, we made our way upstairs to the main exhibit space, full of historical artifacts.
And I'll just tell you a very quick story here, that because this Thornwood cane that you see,
yes,
is to me the most emotional relic that we have. It was an old slave came. He came into town through the Underground Railroad, and he was on his way to Canada. When he got here, he was very ill. He was put under the care of Arthur Gray. And then when he was well enough to travel, they took him in the dead of night down to the river, put him in a rowboat, sent him off to his freedom in Canada. The only thing the old slave owned was this cane. And as he got in the boat, he turned and gave it to Mr. Gray. And it came to us through his family. So
that's incredible.
I think Tom will tell you more about that.
Lewiston's connection to the Underground Railroad runs deep. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1851 put Lewiston on the map because of its close proximity to Canada, a country that had abolished slavery nearly 20 years earlier. I sat down with Tom Collister, curator of the Lewiston Museum.
One of the rendezvous places for the slaves to get to was St. Catharines, Ontario, where Harriet Tubman, as we all know, she had established a church over there and a safe haven for escaping slaves, and she also helped them find transportation, jobs, homes in Upper Canada.
What they needed to build a community.
Yeah. Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of abolitionists in the village itself.
Tell me about, is it Josiah?
Josiah Tryon, yes.
Okay.
Yes, he came here with his brother. His brother Amos was a very famous man, very rich man. And Josiah was the opposite. Josiah was a very religious man, had no children. And he ended up becoming the station master for this area. He used his brother's mansion out on the river to harbor and hide the slaves and help ferry them across the river. And that home is known as Tryon's Folly to us, because Tryon, when he built it for his wife, she refused to go there and live. So the place sat empty. And being half a mile outside the village, it was dense, thick forest. It was a great place to harbor escaping slaves.
How does the museum support the effort to preserving history for generations to come?
Well, one of the things we outwardly do every year, I've taken a lot of pride in doing this every year, is we have children come here from all over Western New York. Mm. They read a book called The Freedom Crossing. It is a historical fiction book. The people in it are fictional characters. The places used in the book are real. They're all still here. And the fourth graders read this book. So they come to the museum. I have a display upstairs. I have about 30 questions I have from the book. I give them 5 minutes to roam around the museum and look at all the artifacts we have. Then I spend another 5 minutes answering questions they may have about those artifacts. And then we get into the meat of it, which is Freedom Crossing. We discuss the book, we discuss slavery, and then I ask them question after question to make sure they read the book and make sure the important facts are in there.
So how many students do you welcome each spring?
We're up to 600 now on average.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Talk to me about how the students react when they're here in this space.
They are absolutely mesmerized when they see the pictures of the actual buildings that they were reading about. They actually walk around the village and see these places for themselves. They visit the church, they visit the home, they visit the cemetery, and they go down to the waterfront and they have lunch and they see how close Canada is, and they see our monument down there and the interpretive signs and stuff. And it's a major deal for them. And a lot of them come back with their parents later on in the summer. They'll tell their parents all about the places and what they learned.
I think that's an amazing lesson and a great way to end our conversation about how important it is to go out and explore and experience history for yourself.
Well, thank you very much.
Coming up next, we're sticking around in the heart of Lewiston to satisfy your sweet tooth with a story of family, tradition, and frozen custard. That's up next, right after this.
From in-depth reporting to musical masterpieces, dramas, and mysteries to local bands, Buffalo Toronto Public Media delivers it all. Stay informed, be inspired, and join us. This is Public Media.
Welcome back to Tapestry, and do we have a sweet treat for you. In the village of Lewiston, there's a little stand that's been scooping up joy since 1939. We're talking about Hibbard's Original Frozen Custard.
We start out every day with 27 and a half gallons of fresh-made custard.
That's Dan Buckner, the custard stand manager.
We run vanilla chocolate, black raspberry, and pistachio every day. All the weekdays we have a flavor of the day. Today being Friday, it's peanut butter.
So you said 27 gallons of mix, and that'll get you through the day?
No.
No?
On a busy day, I could go through 50 to 100 gallons. On holidays, 4th of July, it can be a lot more than that.
Wow.
We let Dan get back to work and sat down with Chris Trunzo from the Hibbard family. She took us back to the very beginning. It's a busy Lewiston morning. We got traffic flowing.
We've got flags flapping.
So you're very close to the Tuscarora Monument, right?
Yes, very close.
And so right behind us, there's an American flag and then a
Seneca Nation flag.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's what we hear in the background.
That's what you hear.
Hibbard's has been around for obviously a very long time. How many years?
86 this year.
And it all started with an entrepreneurial spirit.
Yes.
Of your grandfather?
My grandfather, Harold
okay.
Hibbard.
Well, tell me a little bit about how your family started out on this sweet venture.
My grandfather ventured in St. Petersburg Beach, Florida.
Okay.
And they had a home there on a, you know, on a bay. And he happened to end up next to a gentleman that owned custard stands out in Wisconsin. That gentleman and him, you know, over cigars and
who knows what,
talked and talked. He kind of gave my grandfather all the secrets.
Oh.
That was early 30s. My grandfather came back and he was gung-ho that that's what he was going to do here with frozen custard.
Oh, wow.
And dipped frozen custard.
Dipped frozen custard.
Dipped frozen custard.
Why? How is that important?
Our machines are a direct draw that are water driven, so it comes down denser. A lot of the other machines whip air into the mix, so ours comes in, it's very dense. That's why it melts so very quickly.
You know, I hear that there's something really special about your vanilla custard.
Yes.
Talk to me about what makes it unique or makes it different than others.
Our vanilla custard has been a private recipe, a five-star essence of Madagascar beans that we have made specifically for us.
How will I know the distinctive taste?
It has a higher content of vanilla, so it just really pops when you have the vanilla.
Yeah.
It has a bitey vanilla flavor.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I love, you know, what I'll call plain old vanilla. Clearly we've established that yours isn't plain.
Right.
It is old. But it isn't plain.
It isn't plain, right?
Let's talk about flavor for a minute. You have a unique strategy about flavor here at Hibbard's.
A lot of our newer flavors have come from employees. We have a little machine that you can mix things and try different. We have tons of flavorings, and they'll just mix something together on a break and just say, well, hey, let's just try this, and why don't we try that?
And you let people know ahead of time.
We put it out the day before, and sometimes we'll put it out in a week format so they know if I'm going to go to Hibbard's and I really want creamsicle, I better come on Wednesday because that's the only day we're going to serve. But then in bringing up flavorings, we also have a flavor that we came about by the Bare Naked Ladies were at Art Park doing a performance a few years ago, and they were fans unbeknownst to us of the custard stand, so they came and they tried the flavors, and then when they were on stage and they did If I Had $1 Million, they shouted out, If I Had $1 Million I would live where I could get Hibbard's custard every day on stage. So
to the thousands of people
that were there. So when I heard that, I called the people at Air Park that arranged for them and got a hold of their manager, the band's manager, and asked them if they would be interested in doing a collaborative flavor. And they said, yes, we would. So, So we went down and we met with them, and they told us what their thoughts were. They named it Big Bare Naked Bang over Big Bang Theory. And so we're still serving that. And every year we take the proceeds from that flavor only, and we give it to a local charity. Last couple years, we've given to Love Heart and Soul up in Niagara Falls, a food pantry. Mm-hmm. And we've done it to Girard Place in Buffalo and a lot of different charities.
And what does the flavor taste like? I gotta ask.
It is a coffee-based flavor that has like ground espresso beans and semi-sweet chocolate bits in it.
Oh,
it's an eye opener. They wanted something to keep themselves awake in between sets. So this was what they wanted
for all those late night
for all
gigs,
those late
right?
night gigs. Yeah, exactly.
Do you ever stop and take a minute and think about the legacy of your grandfather?
Oh, yeah.
What would he say if he were here with us today?
I think he's looking down and he's very proud of what it's become. Yeah, it's a very humble legacy for us, because it does touch a lot of people in the community. We still have people that come back and say, my first job was Hibbert's. And we have couples that have met and married as employees. They've met here and end up being married. It's amazing that in this area that is so tight-knit and goes so far-reaching, that there are still people that you run into that said, oh, really? I've never heard of Hibbert's Custard.
Well, I'll be bringing my family this summer.
Well,
for
thank
sure.
you, Lynn. Thank you very much.
That wraps up this episode of Tapestry. We will definitely be back to explore more of Lewiston, maybe to catch the Niagara County Peach Festival. Next, we head to Medina, New York, to check out how this small town reimagined Main Street, celebrates the locomotive, and is the home of Medina Sandstone. I hope you join us. Tapestry is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. You can find all of our episodes on btpm.org and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Lynn Bader. Thanks for listening.